I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. We're all lamenting the state of our democracy wherever one is on the political spectrum. There is much room for improvement. A new book suggests something new altogether. In Tear Down, Rebuilding Democracy from the Ground Up, author Dave Meslin discusses what's wrong with democracy, offers examples where improvement could happen, as well as what to do. We all think the system is rigged, so in a way Mr. Meslin suggests how it could be unrigged. He joined me recently to talk about the book, about how the system works to certain people's advantage, and how the influence of money is as insidious as it is. I'll ask him about voter turnout and its decline, as well as electoral reform, and just where there is hope. Dave Meslin is an activist, artist, and community organizer. He formed the Toronto Public Space Committee in 2005, and his TED Talk on apathy has had over 1.5 million views. The website for more is at teardown.build. The Twitter handle is at Meslin. This new book is published by Penguin. Please welcome to the Plata on the Line program, Dave Meslin. Mr. Meslin, good morning.
Good morning. It's an honor to be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you on. You know, when you use the word tear down, what do you mean? Because a lot of people, you know, might think, you know, a different kind of say, way of governing ourselves, you know, so something fanatical or something extreme. What's involved,
yeah,
say, in tearing it down?
Yeah, so it's I actually explain right at the very first few pages of the book for anyone who's worried that I'm suggesting that there's nothing worthwhile in our current system.
Uh-huh.
I explain that teardowns come in what I call three flavors. So you've got the tear down that we associate with buying an old home that needs to be torn down, in which case you're literally not saving anything, you're just ripping it apart.
Yeah.
But there's two other great ways that the word tear down is used in our language. One is, for example, an engine tear down. So when you're doing an engine tear down, you're actually doing it really carefully. You're taking every single piece apart, cleaning everything, seeing if any parts need to be replaced, for the sole purpose of putting it back together and doing the engine rebuild.
Right.
And then the third way that we use it is more modern. It's in the tech sector. So when a company like Apple or Samsung puts out a new product, really geeky people will buy it just to take it apart, and that's called a teardown. And what they'll do is put photos online of all the chips and wires and things inside it so people can see the guts of the machine. So in that case, a teardown is just taking something apart to learn about it. And I think the book that I've written, which is called Teardown, it does all three.
Yeah.
There are parts of our political system that I think just need to be thrown out in the trash, starting with our voting system. But then I think there's parts where we need to just take a more surgical approach,
yeah,
and take a very close look at all the core micro elements and see what's worth keeping, what needs to be replaced, and what needs to be tweaked.
What's happened, Dave, in the last little bit that's, I guess, necessitated all of us to seriously consider the future of our democracy? Because for some people, it worked well, say, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. What happened in the last little bit that's not only wanted us to change everything, or even just given us the opportunity to seriously look at it all?
Yeah, well, I'm 44. So I don't know what was going on 50 years ago,
right,
but I'll tell you what I've seen during my lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And from what I understand, yeah, it is different than how things used to be. The level of polarization, the level of hostility that we see in our political legislatures, the bickering and the fighting and that takes place instead of meaningful dialogue is disgusting. And it's not only offensive to watch, it's really harmful to all of us, spiritually in one way. I mean, when we see our leaders fighting like children in the House of Commons, I mean, what does that say about all of us? It makes us all look bad, but also it gives us terrible policy. So our policymaking right now is suffering from many things. One is the back and forth. So when you have a polarized political culture that just swings between right-wing parties and left-wing parties, and each new party that comes into power just spends their first year undoing everything that the previous government did.
Yeah.
And we see this all across Canada, provincially and federally. That's so inefficient, right?
Yeah.
But also, when you've got when it becomes more ideologically driven than evidence-based driven, and when you don't even have the capacity for parties to collaborate and talk with each other, or you don't even have the capacity within party caucuses for people to talk to each other because we've centralized power in the leader's office to the extent that most backbenchers within a party have no voice at all, we all lose out because it's only through collaborative dialogue that you'll end up with a good outcome and a smart policy.
What part do you think technology has played in this polarization and this inability for us to talk? I mean, you just look at the comments on news stories or, you know, how people use social media. It's quite divisive. And I can't help but think that these modes of technology that have been sold to us to connect us better have really worked to divide us.
Yeah, I think the technology plays a big part of it, but technology also just reflects larger trends that already exist within society. I think it serves as a mirror. So one of the reasons that hostilities and partisanship and polarization really finds a home on the internet is because our political system is already designed that way. So we pretty much have a two-party system. I mean, we give the NDP wins a few seats now and then, and maybe forms a government once in Ontario, two or three times in BC, a fluke in Alberta, never federally. And of course, the Greens aren't on the map compared to where they should be. Proportionally, they should already have 30 seats in Ottawa.
Sure.
They just won their second. So, for all intents and purposes, in Canada, we have a two-party system, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So when you have that back-and-forth polarization where essentially you've structured all political discourse around this idea that only the blue or the red can win, then, of course, online social media is going to start replicating that, and it becomes a battlefield. If our political systems were designed in the first place, where there were five or six parties working collaboratively as coalitions in government, you wouldn't have as divisive polarization because the structure wouldn't be pre-existing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found curious as I was reading the book is, I mean, you use the words corrupt and rigged, and then one wonders, is it helpful to give, say, credence to the rhetoric that some of the loudest voices on inner politics use today?
Yeah, and I address that directly.
Yeah.
Because I hear that concern all the time, and I proudly use the word rigged because I've seen the system up close. As a staffer, as a lobbyist, as an activist, it is absolutely rigged. And some people will say, as you just said, that if we use words like corrupt or rigged to describe the system, we're feeding the ideologues. And what I propose is that it's the exact opposite. Everyone knows it's rigged. Everyone can tell it's rigged.
Uh-huh.
When we're not comfortable admitting it and saying it, we're giving up that space to other people, like Trump, who will happily take advantage of it. So if right-minded people aren't occupying that space and saying we need to fix the system, you're surrendering political space to people who will not only happily occupy that space but use it for divisive, hostile, and hateful purposes. So I actually want to reclaim that space, and instead of saying the system's rigged, so let's get rid of immigrants or whatever, I want to say the system's rigged, but turn that into a hopeful message.
Yeah.
That's not an admission of defeat. It's an invitation for us to work together to make it better. There's nothing wrong with admitting that a system is failing. It's actually the starting point for renewal.
Right.
It's an optimistic to suggest that we could do better than we're doing now.
Well, what's something that you suggest in the book would say boost the voter turnout during elections? Because, I mean, that's declining regularly. I mean, the last federal election was a bit of a one-off, and I would assume that a lot of people are guessing that the turnout this time around will probably go back to what it usually was. I guess the apathy that voters feel, I mean, what explains that, and how do we reverse that, say?
Right. Well, first of all, we should be aiming our sights pretty high. It infuriates me that people refer to the last election as some kind of great example of good voter turnout. Mm-hmm. It was around 66, I think, right. Something like that. It was in the mid-60s, right?
Yeah.
So that means like one out of every three voters stayed home. You pick any random three Canadians, one of them didn't even bother to participate. That's terrible. That's a terrible voter turnout. The fact that it was slightly higher than what we're used to doesn't mean anything, because we shouldn't be comparing it to the last election. We should be comparing it to what the ideal scenario is, which, of course, would be somewhere in the range of 100, because government really affects our lives. They make really important decisions that affect everyone. It is irrational, nonsensical to remove yourself from decision-making processes that affect your lives. So the goal should be 100. And my answer to your question is that there isn't any one single reform that'll make a big difference, because what we have is a bicycle with it's missing its wheels, it's missing its chain, the seat's broken, the handlebar's broken. You can't just put a new wheel on that thing and go for a ride.
Yeah.
You need to look at the whole ecosystem and fix all of it. There are so many things broken. But I think the voting system itself, the structure of the ballot, and the way that we mathematically decide how the votes turn into seats, changing that would be enormous, because it doesn't just change the math of the seat calculation. It literally changes who runs, how they run, why they run, and then how people vote, how the math is calculated, and then how those elected members work together once elected. It would change so many elements of our political culture overnight.
So when electoral reform has come to a vote in BC, and it has three times in the last, 18 years,
yeah.
In PEI recently with the provincial election there, there was also a referendum side by side.
In Ontario.
Yeah, right. These efforts have gone down to defeat. Why is it that we know that the system's broken, but we're so unwilling to change it?
Yeah, well, first of all, in defense of the 2005 referendum in BC, which was the first one out of all of them,
They
used a great process called a citizens' assembly,
right,
which took the power away from politicians to choose which models would be looked at. They randomly selected citizens from across the province and said, you look at all the options available, you pick the best one for BC, and then we'll have a referendum on it. That was really cool, and that model is now looked at from all over the world as a great example of how to do it right. Because when the people voted in 05, 58% of British Columbians voted yes.
Right.
Which is, I've never seen any government in Canada get that high a number. So the funny thing was, the next day, they said that the referendum lost with 58, but there was a new government in power that probably only had, let's say, 40.
Yeah.
They had set the threshold at 60. So we have won referendums before, but the rules have often been rigged against us. I've got a chapter in the book that talks about all the ways to run a good referendum. When referendums become very divisive, or often become a referendum not on the policy but on government itself, people are just voting no because they're mad at everything, and that's probably a few good examples of that would be the transit referendum in the Lower Mainland,
right.
About 2 years ago, mm-hmm. Maybe Brexit, right? You're just voting no against Parliament because you're so sick of their crap.
Yeah.
So referendums become very divisive. It's really hard to make sure that people are properly informed on both sides of the issues. And also, it's easier to scare people towards a no vote than to convince them sometimes that the change has to happen.
Yeah.
I just think we need to keep trying. And maybe what I've been proposing for the movement is to start local. Let's implement different voting systems in our city councils, and then get people used to that, and then go provincial, and then go federal.
Right.
And the different voting systems we've been looking at for proportionality, like mixed member proportional is what they looked at in Ontario and BC, and the single transferable vote was what was voted on in BC the first two times.
Yeah.
Those both could be used municipally. STV would work great, for example, for Vancouver City Council, which is already at large.
Yeah.
All you have to do is introduce a ranked ballot. And MMP could be used in Montreal, where they've already got single-member districts and a party system.
Yeah. This all, I guess the sort of elephant in the room that I guess is something that we all know about and concerns us is the influence of money in terms of policy on politics itself. How insidious is that?
It's big. It's huge. I went searching for really fun ideas that have been proposed for reform to help kind of level the playing field when it comes to politics, because we know that people with the deepest pockets have enormous amounts of influence in many ways in the halls of power, partially just through their own social networks. But one of the things that really helps them is that they can hire lobbyists. And one of the things the lobbyists do is they serve as kind of a navigator. So they'll help someone understand all the steps of the decision-making process and where they have to be when, who they have to talk to when. They're like a guide, right?
Yeah.
And so the best idea that I've heard that I've proposed in the book is that the cure for lobbying is to have more lobbying, which sounds counterintuitive. But the idea is that politicians should be exposed to as much information as possible from everyone, from the private sector, from community groups and nonprofits and activists. And the more information they have, the better, which means any type of lobbying is good. The problem right now is that they're more likely to be lobbied from someone representing a wealthy interest rather than a grassroots community interest. So the proposal is to create what's called an Office of Public Lobbyists. And it would work similar to legal aid. So if you're low income and you're charged with a crime, you will be given a lawyer by the state to make sure that you can defend yourself properly in court. So the idea of the Office of Public Lobbyists is that organizations or groups could get access to free lobbyists to work on their behalf in the decision-making process. This could work municipally, provincially, federally, and give a guaranteed level playing field so politicians are hearing from both sides of the story. I think that's much more, it might sound radical, but it's much more practical and attainable than the things we've tried so far, which are usually aimed at minimizing lobbying or making it more transparent. Let anyone lobby as much as they want,
yeah,
as long as everyone has access to lobbyists.
In terms of financing campaigns and the sort, I mean, that's a great concern for candidates, for political parties,
yeah,
between election cycles. How can it be done better, say?
Well, in the book, I kind of break down with these little graphics all the different ways, the different mechanisms we have to insert public financing into the election system. And anything that isn't doing that, in my opinion, isn't a cure. So we have, you know, rules about minimizing donations. We have rules about transparency and disclosure. That's all great. But the best cure is when you have public money going in there and financing campaigns. The question always comes down to, how do you decide how to allocate that money?
Yeah.
Which campaigns get the most? And I break down the different systems that have been used, such as the per-vote subsidy, which we have in Canada. But the one that I really, really liked was from Seattle, and it's called a democracy dollar or a democracy voucher. And essentially, you get in the mail coupons. Let's say they're each worth $25, so it's a total of $100.
Yeah.
And you can send that to any candidate you want, and they get that as public financing towards their campaign. So instead of it being a small rebate or a small tax credit, or some kind of matching grant, like in New York, for example, if I give you $10 for your campaign, the city gives you back $8.
Mm-hmm.
In Seattle, you don't have to have any money. You can be someone with no disposable income, nothing in your pockets, and you can still contribute on a level playing field with anyone else. And I think that's a beautiful model.
Yeah, and it also, this points to a greater theme in the book, it's just improving access for everybody,
yeah,
to the system, right?
Yeah, and the other thing is to make sure that the individual districts don't get too big. So, like, Toronto, we just went from 44 seats down to 25. Our council was slashed in half in the name of efficiency. And there's a few problems with that. One is that it makes politicians seem more distant because they were trying to represent a larger group. It's like having a larger classroom. The teacher won't be able to give as much attention to the students. But what it also does is it now doubles the cost of campaigning. So it's literally going to be twice as much to spend to run a good campaign with signs and websites and flyers. So who's got access to that kind of money, right? So if you keep the cost of campaigning lower by having bite-sized districts, that also has a positive impact on the outcome.
Recently, there was an election in Newfoundland, and a minority government was elected there. There are minority governments here in BC, in New Brunswick, and PEI. Does that suggest that more people will have a say in how things are run? Or?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, the way Parliament's supposed to work, let's back up. First of all, the seat counts we have are very distorted. If we had accurate proportional seat counts, every election we've had, pretty much every election except the last one in Alberta, when they actually got a majority, and Mulroney actually got a majority once in the 80s.
Yeah.
But almost every election we have would already be producing what we call minority governments. But we wouldn't call them minority governments. We would call them coalition governments.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just more stable for a few parties to come together and form a majority in the House. And that's how it's done all across Europe. We're the outliers here. Like, when we talk about proportional representation, some people think we're proposing some obscure model that's only used in Israel or Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Most of Europe, including many very successful, moderate, wealthy countries, all use proportional systems. It's the norm, and proportionality means that you're going to end up with a bunch of parties working together, representing a majority of voters, which is how politics should work.
I was talking about before we started our chat just how much I enjoyed the book. I found it accessible and you know, not academic. I mean, there's a hell of a lot of research in it, but it didn't seem like a stuffy academic book. I noticed that you worked with a researcher, Zach Meadow. How would you both work in terms of say, writing a book like this?
Oh, that's an exciting question. So Zach was a university student who, through a placement program, was working on a few projects with me. And then he offered to volunteer his time to work on the book. And I said, well, I'd rather hire you, but I don't have any money right now. So he owns 10% of the book. We created this profit-sharing model, which is really fun.
Uh-huh.
So he came on as the research director with 10% ownership, and we've had so much fun over the last 4 years figuring out how to approach this. And we started by gluing big sheets of cork onto an entire wall of his living room. And the original idea of the book was called 100 Remedies for a Broken Democracy. And the title's changed, but all the 100 ideas are all still in there. And we had a piece of paper for each remedy. And then on each paper, we listed who we should talk to, who we should interview, who we should visit, and examples of where this idea is already being implemented somewhere in the world. And we kind of set up a tour, a research tour, where I actually went out and I was all across North America visiting neighborhood councils in Los Angeles, visiting Democratic schools in Colorado and in New Hampshire, visiting borough councils in Montreal. And a lot of interviews. And then Zach created this really cool Excel spreadsheet, a Google sheet?
Google Doc, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And each remedy was on the doc, and each remedy had a hyperlink to another shared doc where we listed all of our research and interviews. It was really intense. We did over 100 interviews, which I'm sure you can relate to.
Right.
And we transcribed them all, and we were just looking for really inspiring, interesting quotes from people who are pioneers, innovators, and showing by example. We didn't talk to a lot of academics. We wanted people on the ground who are actually implementing innovative ideas that can expand our imagination about what politics can look like.
Yeah. It's a marvelous read, and as I'm reading it, I'm thinking of how broken the system is, and I'm you know, obviously cynical and the sort because of it. But at the same time, when you talk to the people that you do, there's a real sense of hope, isn't there? I mean, you really do believe in people, and that not only small groups, but one person even in many situations can change something, right?
Absolutely. And the book is called Teardown, but I hope people also know what the what the subheading is, which is rebuilding democracy from the ground up. Mm. So it's got the negative because I think it's really important to be realistic and have a real firm grasp of how big the problem is. But the flip side of that is a huge dose of optimism, that once we've identified all the pitfalls and the obstacles, we can overcome them. And there's already experiments happening all over the place. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are countries using better voting systems. There are cities who have made their political spaces more inviting. There are, you name it. For every problem I identify in the book, there's someone who's experimenting with a remedy. And what I'm trying to do is tell their stories in a fun and playful way. And I don't know if there's a lot of books out there that try and be angry and playful at the same time.
Right.
And that's what we try to do, and I think we achieved it.
You've succeeded. Yeah, it's an engaging book. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it. Thanks for this.
Thank you so much for the chat.
The book is called Tear Down, Rebuilding Democracy from the Ground Up. It is published by Penguin. Its author, Dave Meslin, joined me on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.